behind tab 12. Dr. Cadron will present the 2011 calendar and ABC recommendations for Gulf of Maine Winter Flounder, as well as discuss the five-year council research recommendations and the status of our council's ABC control rules. After that, we'll have a presentation from Dr. O'Boyle and Mike Fogarty on the SSC's ecosystem-based fishery management policy paper. Dr. Cadron, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for reserving 2 hours for this. I hope that my portion of it is relatively quick so that we can focus on the EBFM presentation by Bob O'Boyle. At our November meeting, there were several agenda items. The primary agenda items were catch advice for Gulf of Maine winter flounder and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, as well as the final review for the ecosystem-based fishery management plan policy paper. Quickly going over SSC business, we had a review of the national SSC meeting. The primary agenda items there were acceptable biological catch control rules and peer review processes. We discussed that and the implications for New England SSC at the meeting. There's also a meeting coming up to coordinate the Mid-Atlantic New England SSCs with the capabilities of the Population Dynamics Branch in Woods Hole so that we can meet the requirements of annual catch limits. We provided feedback for the stock assessment workshop in terms of reference for all three winter flounder stocks. We discussed a habitat methods peer review that is under development. Also discussed appointments for the next three-year cycle for SSC members and the calendar for next year. I'll be presenting on the primary agendas for our meeting, which was Gulf of Maine winter flounder and Georges Bank winter flounder. Starting with Georges Bank winter flounder, we reported to the council in September on the status of winter flounder. Going back to 2008, the most recent benchmark assessment rejected all alternative assessments, and so we do not have a status determination for Gulf of Maine winter flounder. However, the panelists concluded that it is highly likely that biomass is below BMSY, and there's substantial probability it's below half BMSY. So this may be an overfished resource. Based on that assessment and the conclusions by the review panel, in 2009, the SSC recommended an acceptable biological catch that was based on 75% of the most recent three-year average catch. So this is no assessment was the basis for this. All we had was recent catch, and we took 75% of that as our recommendation to the council. Last June, the council approved a motion asking the SSC to examine any information that had been collected since the last benchmark assessment to reconsider whether the current ABC recommendation could be changed. The PDT had prepared information for our August SSC meeting. At that time, we recognized that there were still conflicting signals in the survey data. Some trends were pointing upward, others downward. The plan development team did develop an alternative approach for deriving the catch limit that was consistent with the ABC control rule for groundfish and used area-swept survey biomass. Using the area-swept survey biomass, the PDT and the SSC concluded that the current acceptable biological catch, 238 tons, represents a more conservative exploitation rate than the 75% FMSY suggested by the groundfish control rule. At that time in September, we reported to the council that this should be considered, that the PDT should provide further information so that we could consider revising our acceptable biological catch recommendation. The PDT responded to our requests. They provided all of the further analyses that we had suggested for the area swept biomass estimate, as well as its uncertainty and the alternative catches that could be associated with those biomass estimates. The results suggested that 350 to 450 tons of catch were unlikely to exceed the overfishing threshold and appear to have been sustainable in the past. However, the SSC was not able to evaluate the effect that these catches would have on the winter flounder stock. Given concerns that it may be overfished, we don't know whether an increased ACL will jeopardize the likelihood of rebuilding. And without information on these risks, the SSC could not come to consensus on a recommendation for a revised catch at this time. Fortunately, there is a benchmark assessment scheduled for next spring. That process will start this winter to develop data. And so there will be a basis to revise the 2011 acceptable biological catch. In addition to this, the SSC provided feedback based on the area swept survey biomass that this be explicitly considered in the next benchmark assessment next spring. So our recommendation is that the ABC for Gulf of Maine winter flounder remain at the existing 238 tons until information from the new assessment is available. I'll entertain questions on this if you'd like at this point.
Any questions? Nancy?
I got to reach over for this. Steve, I appreciate that you looked at that area swept method relative to biomass estimation. And I would guess that rather than just doing that with the upcoming winter flounder assessment, which is next spring, that you guys would probably suggest that we take a look at that as a measure for similar species, most of the flatfishes, for example, and perhaps some of the other species as well. Did you have any discussion about that? Beyond winter flounder?
No, our discussion at our last meeting was focused on winter flounder, but note that the GARM, GARM 3 in 2008 transitioned from relative abundance indices to area swept indices, and if we go back to this year's transboundary assessment committee, there were area swept biomass estimates provided for Georgia's Bank Yellowtail as well. So I think this is a general approach that the council will be seeing more of.
Anything else? Anyone else? David?
Yes. There's a great deal of information provided in this ring binder, and it's good information as you can do some calculations from it. And I call people's attention to page 31. It's figure 15. It's on exploitation estimates spring 2009. And it's about this whole idea of using the survey as a proxy for what's out there. And unless I've misinterpreted these graphs, it basically you have to assume 100% efficiency for the survey with a 500-ton quota or ACL for Gulf of Maine winter flounder in order to exceed our rebuilding F rate. If you use 0.6, 0.8, or any of the smaller tonnages, you don't exceed our rebuilding rate. So I'm a little bit curious why we're still staying at 238 when it would appear that we could go to, say, 400 and still be well under what any of this information tells us would jeopardize rebuilding.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, you're looking at the right tables there. That was the basis for the PDT and the SSC's conclusion that increases were unlikely to exceed overfishing. I have one minor correction, is that it's not exceeding F rebuild. It would be exceeding the overfishing reference point. And that was exactly the central argument that we debated, was that because the previous peer review panel was concerned that this resource may be overfished, we don't know what F rebuild is. That table gives you the probability of exceeding the overfishing reference point, but it may be that the council needs to consider a more conservative rebuilding ABC, and that's why we weren't able to reach consensus for a revised catch advice.
Okay.
Chairman, I'll just offer one comment, and that is that if any gear has 100% efficiency, I want a net plan immediately. Because I think I'm pretty good at building nets, and I know my nets don't even come close to that. So I think that it just indicates to me how much work needs to be done on winter flounder, and the sooner the better, because this is the choke stock of all choke stocks in the north. And, you know, again, I appreciate the fact that the raw data was supplied because it gave you a chance to go through it and see just what ideas are being formulated. Thank you.
Anything else on winter flounder before Dr. Cajun moves along? Okay, Steve.
Moving on to Georges Bank Yellowtail, you may remember that it's been updated last summer at the July Transboundary Assessment Committee. The track had noticed that the assessment had a retrospective pattern again, where there appears to be overestimating stock size every time we update the assessment. The Transboundary Management Guidance Committee concluded that the most appropriate catch for Georges Bank Yellowtail was 1,900 tons, because that was expected to allow rebuilding in the short term and had a low risk of overfishing, even if the retrospective inconsistency persisted. There are uncertainties in the assessment, but the SSC concluded they were insufficient to modify the catch advice, and so we were able to base our catch advice directly on the assessment and its projections. Any concerns about recent recruitment affect both the short-term projections and the rebuilding target, so alternative assumptions of future recruitment should affect both your rebuilding target as well as your projected catch. The Council is now considering additional rebuilding strategy that was not part of our recommendations in September, and so they requested the SSC to provide an additional ABC recommendation for the additional rebuilding strategy. That's provided here along with all of the other options that we provided recommendations for in September. And so in the bold is the new catch advice for 2011 and 2012 based on a 60% probability of rebuilding by 2019. And just looking at the range of catch advice for those different rebuilding in context of recent catch, we have either reduced catch for some of the more rigorous rebuilding and slight increases in catch for the more liberal rebuilding plans. That's all I have for Yellowtail.
Questions for Steve? Okay.
All right, moving forward into research priorities. I only have this one slide on this, but I'll refer you to a more extensive memo to the Council prepared by the SSC. As a bit of background, there's a legal mandate for the Council to provide 5-year research priorities. This has been done in the past through several committees of the Council, including the Research Steering Committee, plan committees, plan development teams, and the SSC itself. Last year, the SSC felt that we could add more value than simply stapling together a lot of different research recommendation lists, and we could actually start to consolidate, identify common themes across the lists, and more importantly, to prioritize, from the SSC's view, what the most important research priorities are for the region. And so this list is a compilation of all of the previous lists that you've seen, and we were able to identify 9 research priorities. These are somewhat digested here, but they're explained in much more detail in the memorandum. The first is to incorporate risk assessment into the annual catch limit and accountability measures setting process. Second, design an ecosystem-based fishery management plan. Third, evaluate the effectiveness of groundfish regulations. Four, determine how to use assessments with retrospective patterns. 5, develop reliable indices for those species that are not well indexed by the bottom trawl survey. 6, quantify discards, discard mortality and incidental mortality. 7, research on stock structure and biological rates, that's growth, maturity. 8, identify and evaluate methods to reduce habitat impacts. And finally, 9, evaluate the cost and benefit of generating social and economic data streams similar to the catch data streams and survey data streams that are typically provided for fishery management. That's all I have on research priorities, but I welcome questions.
Any questions for Steve? And as Steve mentioned, there's a more detailed memo on this topic in your binders behind tab 12. I think it says research priorities number one. It's a document. Jimmy?
Yeah, Dr. Cadron, I notice, you know, and I've sat through just a few of the GARMs, and I notice that one of the problems seems to be coming to grips with natural mortality. And I don't see that as a research priority of trying to come to grips with natural mortality and what it really is by species. I don't know, can you fill me
yeah,
why,
that's actually, I'm glad you raised that because I didn't mention it and it's not in my digested version. But number seven, our research on stock structure and biological rates, we do explicitly say natural mortality in 7B. 7B is improve the knowledge on age and growth, longevity, reproduction, and natural mortality with priority placed on monkfish, skates, wolffish, red hake, and red crab. And so we agreed with your statement, Jim, is that natural mortality is one of the big unknowns in these assessments and is a priority for research.
Okay, moving along.
The next agenda item we had was to review all of the New England acceptable biological catch control rules. We did this by going through all of our advice for the last 2 years to the council on our catch advice, both our initial advice and any revised advice that we had, trying to compare and contrast our approaches among plans and among management actions. We also went out to other regions in the nation and how those SSCs are confronting the same challenge of providing ABC control rules with their councils. We formed two general terms of reference in this evaluation. The first is essentially how well does our ABC control rule conform to the Act, and that is their expected performance for avoiding overfishing. The second is essentially how well does the control rule conform to the guidelines, and that is, does it account for scientific uncertainty and the council's desired risk tolerance? I'm providing up here an example from our scallop acceptable biological catch control rule in which a range of fishing mortality is presented and the probability of overfishing, but also contrasted with that is the foregone yield. And so we have both dimensions of National Standard 1, low risk of overfishing and achieving optimum yield. And the council used this to determine that their risk tolerance would be 0.25 because that has low risk of overfishing and not much foregone yield. We feel this is our best example of providing information to the council so that they could make an explicit risk tolerance decision. Now, this is our best example, and we would like to move toward this with a lot of our other plans and a lot of the other stocks that we provide advice for, but we need to develop the scientific basis for that advice, and we dearly need feedback from the council on its risk tolerance. We were fortunate to have the council chair sit in on this portion of the SSC meeting, and it will be on our agenda for next year. And the council will be giving us terms of reference for next year, hopefully to meet the September specification process so that we can have more explicit risk decisions in the next cycle of management actions. I can take questions on that if you like.
Jim?
And not knowing if this is really the right question, but should we also look at the risk curve in association with economic and social impact curve, because it seems to me that you may at some point say, okay, this is, we're willing to take a little more risk because of this benefit, or, you know, taking such a risk adverse is going to have such a negative impact that we may want to be a little more, take a little more risk. So is that something that you're talking about with this?
That would be exactly the feedback that we would like in each of the plans. What utilities does the council want to maximize or avoid? And what we're showing here are just two dimensions, risk of overfishing and foregone yield. But you very easily could put in economic yield there. Is that what fishing mortality is going to give you the most economic yield, and what's the risk of deviating from that economic yield? What are the costs of being conservative? So if you have low risk of overfishing, there may be greater economic costs. And so this certainly could be cast in a cost-benefit analysis. You could also have social utilities such as jobs, other community metrics, that the council wishes to be part of the risk equation.
Okay, to follow up on that, at what point in the process should the council weigh in on that?
That's an excellent question, and I mean the SSC responds to requests from the council. So it would be appropriate at this point for the council and the executive committee to ask the right questions. And we can help you with that, and we expect that this will take several iterations where you ask for things like how do social economics be brought in, or you're more explicit about what your objectives are. We can try to evaluate that and give you feedback on that. But I think the ball is now in your court to try to ask us the right questions with respect to this risk.
I just don't want to drop this point. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you, at what point should we engage in this, and should we have a separate committee? Should we let the executive committee? I'm just wondering where in the process we should take that initiative that Steve just laying out for us.
Yeah, I mean, I've attended all but one SSC meeting, and I think I make the comment at every SSC meeting that we need the SSC's help in translating what our risk tolerance are, what factors we want to put into the decision making when they go off and look at setting the ABC. I don't have the perfect or the right answer right now, I don't think, or an answer other than I think the last SSC meeting we talked about the leadership of the SSC and the leadership of the council talking offline about setting up a proposal for the council to entertain to get to that point so that we do have input prior to them setting the ABCs. So it would involve the council. Sure.
So I guess this will be one of our work processes that we're going to, you know, offline work that's going to be done.
Yep.
So I can be satisfied with that?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't want to go through another spec setting process without the council having the ability to weigh in on this.
Okay, thank
plan
you.
By plan as
yeah.
We go through the plans.
Great.
No, those are good questions. David?
Yeah, what exactly would we be allowed to consider in risk tolerance at this point? For example, things like yield per recruit have kind of gone off the table in the last 10 years or so. We haven't considered that in a long time, and yet that may be something that we may wish to use as a parameter for measuring what kind of risk we're willing to take. Can we even do that under Magnuson as it currently exists, or are we so constrained that we can't even consider some of these concepts anymore?
Yeah, I encourage the council to embrace both aspects of National Standard 1. The first aspect of National Standard 1, we feel that we're doing with all of our ABC control rules, and that is having low risk of overfishing. And there's court precedence on this that it needs to be less than 50% risk. But the other aspect of National Standard 1 is achieving optimum yield. And optimum yield, as defined in the Act, has social, economic, ecological considerations. And so all three of those should be considered by the council in determining optimum yield. And that could be yield per recruit, but it could be much broader than that as well. And again, just based on the definition of the Act, that optimum yield has social, economic, and ecological factors.
Anything further from the council? Any other questions? Okay, Steve.
Wrapping up here, just looking forward to next year. I believe the council met yesterday to decide on the new cycle of SSE membership. All of our three-year terms are up. This was our last meeting with the existing SSC membership. So with the new membership, we will have elections for chair and vice chair, meet in mid-February to go over ABC recommendations for the HAICS. Those are going through the stock assessment workshop as we speak for Silver HAIC, Red HAIC, and Offshore HAIC. To pick up this ongoing agenda item of risk evaluation, hopefully we will have some correspondence between the SSC leadership and the council leadership on how to frame the next iteration of this conversation. We'll also be reviewing the next stage of ecosystem-based fishery management that we'll start on today, and we'll report to the council in April. Later that year, we'll have ABC recommendations for groundfish. All of the winter flounder stocks will go through the stock assessment workshop, and we'll have Georgia's Bank Yellowtail for the Transboundary Assessment Committee. ABC recommendation for skates are due for the new specification cycle. And again, this risk evaluation, we'll have several iterations on this through the next year, reporting to the council in September. We expect that there will be a need for an autumn meeting, if nothing else, to go over our annual calendar, updated research recommendations, and to review the national SSC meeting. That's all I have, and if there are no more questions, I will pass the microphone to the other members of the SSC. Bob O'Boyle and Mike Fogarty have taken the lead on the development of the ecosystem-based fishery management white paper. But any questions before I
Paul Howard.
Hand this over to them?
Just one quick one, Mr. Chairman. Steve, since this is kind of a wrap-up for the year and we committed the SSC resources to support our SOSARC and workshops and things like that, how has that worked out from your perspective, having the folks join the SOSARC and chair those and work groups? Pretty good?
Yeah, we've had one cycle on that so far since we've been into this ACL process. SAW 50, we were able to have the chair, Bob O'Boyle, chaired that meeting, and Pat Sullivan was also one of the SSC members. Also in the Transboundary Assessment Committee, both J.J. McGuire and I were able to sit on that. We feel that that does allow for the continuity between the peer review and the SSC recommendations. Provide some institutional memory as well as some accountability in the system so that the peer review is not completely independent, so that the reviewers just walk away afterward, leaving us with results that are difficult to deal with. There's also some feedback to the peer review process on the new requirements of the ACL process and what that requires of the management system. And so I think that has helped, and I know that it's at great cost to the council to provide that, but I think there's a benefit to that cost as well.
Rick?
And to comment from the center's perspective, I think this has worked really well. It's done a lot for the peer review process within the SARC. I think one of the major steps, which you didn't mention, is that it grounds them in some sort of reality. In the past, they had a tendency to drift away from at times, not recognizing this was meant for a management process. I think having the SSC there in the room, even if it's just one person, and frequently there's more than one there, really helps us with that. Jim Weinberg tries to control them and keep them unmarked, but having someone from the SSC there really helps. So thank you.
We were very fortunate to get some substantial funding for that for this year. And where I see Sam Rausch is in the room, I wanted him to hear how well that program worked out as we look towards a very healthy 2011 budget to support our SSC. Thank you.
You got that, Sam? Okay. Anything further for Dr. Cadron? Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up quickly on this question of risk and ABC control rules. And, based on what we've seen so far, one of the gaps that we have and an area where we really need to make some progress, I think, is in having a common understanding between the SSCs and the Science Center as to what exact information is needed to go with that OFL estimate and the distribution and what types of uncertainties are being characterized in that distribution so that we can have a common understanding going through the assessment and update process, because when the probabilistic approach is used and a control rule is applied, the buffering is going to be highly sensitive to the shape of that distribution of the OFL. And I think that's an area where we really have the potential to make some good progress. So I'm looking forward with some anticipation to this meeting of the joint committees in December, and would hope that'll allow for I think some good dialogue between both committees and the assessment scientists. And I think as we go forward, that's an area where we can make a lot of progress, because the example of the scallops and the trade-offs between the buffering and the loss of yield and then the cost of that buffering, it's very cheap if you have a data-rich fishery, but a lot of our assessments aren't that precise, and so that's really where the rubber meets the road, and I think that'll be a constructive step forward with that meeting.
Thank you. Okay, anything else for Dr. Cadron? Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Dr. Bob, Dr. Mike, come on down. And I believe there's two documents that people should be aware of. There's a bulletin a brochure that looks like this, that is sort of a Reader's Digest version of the policy paper. And there's also a presentation marked EBFM number 2 that the good doctors will be running us through. And I'm going to move to the back of the room so I can watch the screen, and I'll be back afterwards. So take it away.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, New England Fisheries Management Council. It is indeed an honor for me, Bob O'Boyle. I am Bob O'Boyle, and this is Mike Fogarty, both members of the SSC. It is indeed a pleasure for us to be here to provide the first overview of what we envision to be ecosystem-based fisheries management in the Northeast region. Now, this communicator, I hope, works. Let's have a look. Yep. All right. Proper thing. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Karen. We're good. So as I said, this is EBFM for the ecosystem-based fisheries management for the New England Fisheries Management Council, Northeast Region. It was put together by the Scientific and Statistical Committee with all membership of it. We had a great deal of meetings on this. But it also has significant contributions from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center in Woods Hole, and specifically Mike Fogarty's team. So you'll see running through this the SSC as well as the Northeast Fisheries Science Center's contributions. So the background to this is in 2008, the Council did initiate a process to get an EBFM plan in place. Talking to John and to Dave Preble, we're looking at developing this over the next 3 to 5 years. In response to that, the SSC drafted a white paper, and in this white paper we outlined the need for EBFM, a strategy for implementation, fisheries management, what it would look like under EBFM, and we looked at the consequences for the council's institutions. So how is this going to change how we do business? And we looked at some immediate next steps. The white paper is about a 20-some-odd page long document, and the brochure that John mentioned, put together by the Northeast Fish Science Center, that you should have copies of. That's a 4-pager, and is a required reading for everybody. In fact, it'll be a snap quiz at the end on that, so we'll have there. The white paper was based, as I said here, there's a number of points went into the white paper. First, I do want to emphasize we did have in August 2009 an extensive stakeholder workshop. That was the one in Newport, Rhode Island, where we covered many of the elements in the white paper, and indeed throughout the white paper there are contributions from that workshop. In the SSC itself had, I think, 3 or 4 meetings on where we go in relation to ecosystem-based fisheries management, so that's built in the white paper. And we did, in fact, have feedback from council and staff as they came to the SSC meetings, and we asked them where we should go and that sort of thing. Now, the presentation I'm providing today, that's going to be an overview. And we're going to sort of go through the white paper and say the various elements and what we as the SSC feel is the way we want to go in relation to EBFM. But we want to take your feedback from the council to say, okay, where are the areas where we need to put more detail in for more, more description of what we think is going to be EBFM, so to come back to the council in January and in April to sort of roll this out to you to say, okay, yeah, here's the big picture, but we'll come back in January and April on specific issues and points that you think are worthy of coming back to. I understand that in June 2011, the council is going to be talking about where we're going to go. Okay, this is the way we're going or not. Maybe some decisions on that, but up to you. It is indeed obviously up to you to say, okay, well, how far along and when do you actually make that decision? I think we want to put the ecosystem-based fisheries management into the broader context, and specifically in relation to that, there is a very important and very significant executive order on July of 19th of this year, dealt by the White House, implementing a new national ocean policy. This policy established ecosystem-based management as the guiding principle, and marine spatial planning as the primary tool for ocean resource management. I think this is important. EBFM is the fisheries component of EBM. So the question has to be, what is ecosystem-based management? Well, as I said, ecosystem-based fisheries management is a part of the broader ecosystem-based management. You can see from the overhead there, from the national policy, say, okay, it's adaptive, specified geographically, takes into account uncertainties, considers multiple external influences, strives to balance diverse social objectives, and so on. I think the important point here, though, is that EBFM initiative is underway in this country. I think the council is very well placed by moving ahead on ecosystem-based fisheries management to be part engaged in this process, and dare I say, over the next 3 to 5 years, to be ahead of the curve on this. I think that's important. So looking at some of the benefits on ecosystem-based fisheries management, and hopefully these will become more apparent as I go through the presentation. First of all, simplification of the management structures. What we are looking at is coming up with a planning process that is more simplified under, say, ecosystem-based fisheries management. Coordination of the management actions for stocks, protected species, biodiversity, habitat, and whatever. As you well know, there's very many policies and legislation that is available, or as they have to follow, covering all these various elements. Ecosystem-based fisheries management will be one consolidated means to bring all these together to make a coherent whole. Comprehensive consideration of the fisheries and biological interactions. So, yes, there is consideration of those now, but we're talking about a system that will comprehensively consider all these. Account for the ecosystem constraints on rebuilding. Right now, there are rebuilding targets for virtually all the resources in the area. The question has to be asked, are these all mutually compatible? Underneath ecosystem-based fishery management, what we are proposing, a system that you will allow to look at, are they in fact compatible? And maybe there might not be possible to rebuild all these resources at the same time to their targets. Consideration of climate change. Climate change, as we all know, is an environmental event that's going to be affecting all of us. And what we have to do is prepare ourselves, how will this affect our fisheries? And underneath ecosystem-based fisheries management, hoping that this is where we're going to be able to bring this to the table. And then finally, coordination of the state ecosystem-based management efforts at the state level and in the Northeast Regional Oceans Council level, and indeed in other parts of the adjacent states and adjacent regions, just coordination with the EBM efforts. All right. And finally, I think underneath what's running throughout all the EBFM is enhanced stewardship from broader participation in the process. We're hoping, and we do see as a vision throughout this plan, greater participation from all the stakeholders in the planning process. So the question is, Bob, how do you get there from here? I'm going to roll out the next 3 or 4 slides. I'm going to walk through the transition that the SSC sees as the way forward on EBFM. This chart here, and I hope I push the right button, don't get beamed out of the room. That was not the right button. Top one. Thank you, Karen. This is the current fisheries management plan structure. And obviously, we have, I think, about 9 fisheries management plans. And these are what these light blue boxes are. And right now, we have FMPs that are considered separately. They're treated separately. There's no consistent approach toward consideration of the fishery and biological interactions amongst the species and plants. And there's no direct consideration of the ecosystems in which the species occur. So that's where we are right now. And these FMPs, of course, as I say here, are based on the single species assessments. So the first step as part of this transition, what we are proposing, is we put these existing plans, these FMPs here, light blue boxes, within the context of ecosystems in which they occur. So, for instance, in this schematic here, let's say we have 2 ecosystems in the northeast region, ecosystem 1, ecosystem 2. And then we put in the previous slide I had 4 FMPs in the front top area and 3 in the bottom area. Again, these FMPs are based on the single species assessments. All right? So the idea is to start to begin to consider how species and fisheries covered by these different plans interact through bycatch, predation, whatever, within these ecoregions. And I'll be coming back to these ecoregions later in the talk. That's the first step. Second step is to move to what we call a transitional FMP structure. So here's our current FMP structure with the management plans we have right now within the 2 ecoregions. What we're saying now is let's extend the FMPs based on extended single species assessments. And we develop a formal process to take interactions among species and fisheries into account. This could be an ecosystem committee, for instance. So what we have here is, and also count for climate and environmental effects. So by moving from this current FMP structure to the transitional structure, we're saying, all right, let's now start to extend the single species assessments and then start to make linkages within each ecoregion amongst all these fisheries management plans. And do this through a formal process. So here's the current structure in the New England Fisheries Management Council and the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. And you can see all the various management plans here. The dark blue boxes are, of course, in our area here, and the Mid-Atlantic are in these light, less, what color, whatever that is. Anyway, what is spelling dogfish is. So this is the current fisheries management plan structure. You can see it's, you put it all in one slide, it's quite embracing, so to speak, that how much diversity and complexity we have here. The idea is underneath ecosystem-based fisheries management, we make linkages amongst these plans. So here's herring right in the middle of it all. It's consumed by all these various species, or impacted. Spotted dogfish likes it. All these animals over here, they like it. Basically, if you're a herring, you're liked. Okay, but you can see that all these other plans, they all are associated in some way, shape, or form with sea herring. So in the case, well, the colors don't come out quite nicely on this one, but the idea is that in the transitional phase, which I mentioned earlier, where we have these extended single species assessments, ecosystem level 1, ecosystem level 2, or region 2, herring is going to be considered as part of the planning process as both a fish resource exploited by fleets, as well as a forest species, eaten by everything else out there. And we do have the methodologies to estimate what other animals out there, what other fish out there consume herring. And we also have estimates of what the fleets consume. And the idea is part of the whole ecosystem-based fisheries management, we'd look at both herring as a fisheries source as well as a forest species. So then it comes to transition to the full ecosystem-based fisheries management. You might recall I was talking about 2 ecoregions. This is ecoregion 1, ecoregion 2. What we are planning to do, what we propose doing, is that the final step would be to replace the extended single species FMPs with smaller number of integrated management plans for the ecological regions on the Northeast Shelf. And these EBF plans would directly or indirectly cover all species in the ecosystem. So what I'm talking about here is there, in fact, would be 2 plans, one plan on the north, one plan on the south. Inside those plans would be EBFM modules based on integrated ecosystem assessments. So this last step, going from the extended single species plans to the ecosystem based species management plans, is going to be a big, that's going to be a big step. So here's a synopsis. We go from the current situation where we have, say, in top, the, you know, this ecosystem number two, this region two, where we have four plans. We go down to one plan through a transition process. In this ecosystem region one, we'd have three plans going right through to this one plan again type thing. Needless to say, we have actually nine FMPs. The intent is to move to a smaller subset of FMPs, ecosystem FMPs here. And in the middle, there's this transition stage where we take the existing structure and put more formal linkages in our plans. That's where we think we're going. So there's a number of elements of ecosystem fisheries management that we need to consider in making this transition. And this slide here is the roadmap for the full EBFM. Now, I'm hoping that this does not scare everybody. You say, holy mackerel, we now have eight steps to move through or whatever that is. And eight steps. These steps, in fact, if you look at them, they are all the elements of even single species management. You need to find objectives. You need to have management units. You need to understand the productivity potential of your resource. You need to have reference points. You need to have an allocation strategy. What are the trade-offs? Implementation, management tools, and you need to assess what's going on. So in doing a full EBFM, the elements are exactly the same, but the content and what you do at each one of these elements might be different. And what I'm going to do is going to quickly go through each one of these elements to give you a sense of what is entailed in each one of these. Let's take the objectives first. Ecosystem level objectives. Mike and I were at the Wakefield conference last week in Anchorage, Alaska, and there was a number of papers that gave ecosystem objective structures for projects planning, well, EBFM around the world. And it's interesting, many of them use the same structure in general that what I'm going to show here. You start off with high-level conceptual or aspirational objectives, and then you get down into the lower-level operational objectives that have indicators and reference points. And these are the ones you actually start to manage your fisheries and your ecosystems with. These higher-level objectives generally have concepts like biodiversity, productivity, and habitat. And, of course, we also have to add to these, we have a need for socioeconomic objectives. So as part of the movement to EBFM, we are going to have to come up with these objectives. And there's a number of ways of doing that, which we can cover in discussion. Second step, as I mentioned in the roadmap, is spatial units. Our spatial units we use right now are the stock units, the fishery / stock management unit. When you go to the ecosystem level, we're going to have to ecosystem spatial management units. And Northeast Fisheries Science Center has done a fair bit of work on this to identify these various colors. These are what we call ecological regions or units based on depth, bottom type, oceanography, and food at the base of the food chain. So what this is basically done through analysis that Mike and his group have been doing is looking at how the productivity in these various areas changes or is consistent, and these could be, in fact, the basis for ecosystem management units. Now, the boundaries amongst these units is dynamic and open to oceanographic exchanges and species movements. We still do need to have management units for an EBFM, and we propose that using this approach as a basis for those. Now, it is possible as part of this structure to include subregions. This particular chart has coastal units in here, that's just inside the white line, and a shelf units on the outside here. So it is possible to come up with substructure to these as well. That would be part of the spatial unit management process, the establishment of those. I also do want to add that these spatial units would become the focus of the monitoring of cumulative ecosystem impacts of fisheries. We mentioned the SASE model that the habitat committee has developed, and this could be a tool to assess the cumulative impacts of habitat of fishing within each one of these ecological regions. So once you've got these ecological regions, you need to establish, just estimate what the fishery production potential is, how much fish and shellfish that region can produce. Now, this is based on, and Mike's group has been using energetic approaches to do this, has looked at how much food at the base of the food chain and how much energy transferred up through one level to the next. And this is going to, of course, be impacted by environment and climate conditions and whatever. So for each one of these ecological regions, we can come up with aggregate estimates of how much fisheries potential is there, production potential. We have to come up with ecological reference points. And in relation to this, there are models available that we can, and familiar. In fact, some of these were discussed at the GARM 3, on multi-species production models. And these can estimate the production and, well, associated reference point for species complexes. And I give it an example here. This is where you have the, my eyesight is failing me. This is percent of the maximum, and this is your exploitation rate. This exploitation rate is the what would be an ecosystem level exploitation rate. And you can sort of see there's the yield curve, or traditional your bell curve for the yield. And this curve here, it was actually developed or was determined through simulation, that as you increase, it's the number of species, the number of species slash stocks that collapse as fishing exploit the ecosystem level exploitation rate increases. So as you increase this ecosystem level exploitation rate, yes, you get more yield out of the system, but there's the number of collapses in your resource increases as well. So you can go from, but we would say, okay, well, what you can do, in fact, is go from this maximum here. Let's not fish at the maximum. Let's fish down here, similar to the concepts we've had on the single species level, where a dramatic drop in your overall exploitation rate will, in fact, lose not much yield. That's the yield loss there. But on the other hand, the number of collapses goes, say, from this level here, which is what my eyesight is failing me again, say something over 40%, can actually go to quite low levels at this lower level here. So there are tools that we have right now that can come up with the reference points at an ecosystem level. And we're proposing that during the transition phase, we start to explore these to say how these work in practice. Once you've got your overall production, once you've got your reference points, you say how much can be taken from the system, you need to allocate that. And there are ways to do this. Some of these ways are being come back from the days of ICNAF. And we can do this in a way that does not exceed the total safe catch from the system as a whole. We do have some techniques that can allocate this total catch to species and to fisheries. And when you do these allocations, you need to identify the trade-offs. You need to confront these trade-offs that arise among species and fishes that interact. So we know that, obviously, if species interact with predation, for example, actions that affect prey will also affect the predator. Now, these are taken account of now, these are occur now, but are not correctly acknowledged in the current management system. And these trade-offs, they relate very, very directly back to the objectives that I mentioned in one of my first slides. So having your objectives, you can look at these trade-offs and say, okay, what happens if we allocate the resources this way versus that way? And what are the trade-offs on that? And how these influence the achievement of our objectives? Selecting the right management tools. We see the same suite of management tools being used under EBFM that we have right now. Effort limitation, gear modification, time area closures, output controls, TACs, quotas, whatever you want. But these management tools would be linked through your objectives right down. So they'd be linked back to the objectives. In other words, in order to achieve an objective, say, biodiversity or whatever, you'd have one set of tools. Another objective would be tied to another objective would be tied to another set of tools. And finally, evaluate the outcomes. How are we achieving the objectives? And I think this obviously is when we have stock assessment in the single species methodology we have right now, the approach we have right now. When you go to ecosystem-based fisheries management, we're talking integrated ecosystem assessment. And this provides us with a synopsis of, are we achieving our objectives? Do we need mid-course corrections? And hopefully we have continued, we will need continued monitoring and analysis to detect problem areas. So assessment is a key part of the process, obviously. So that's the roadmap. I think what I'd like to do in the rest of the talk is to talk about what the, some of this human dimension is and some of the changes we see in the council structure. I think starting with the human dimension, the shift from single to multi-species approach will necessitate a change in how human dimension of fishing is approached. There will be need for greater analyses of human resource use, projecting future needs and changes, vulnerable resilience of human communities and what have you, and greater participation in the decision-making process, specifically when you start talking about trade-offs, fishery trade-offs, and co-management. And I think that as part of, as we evolve into this, we're going to be, you know, we have to keep this in mind, that we want to have early engagement with stakeholders as we walk through this to say, okay, what's the best way to engage everybody in this process, the redesign of the process, so to speak. So let's just quickly, we all know these, the current council institutions. We have oversight committees, the speech committees. We have advisory panels, the plan development teams. We have the SSC, which Mike and I are members of. And, of course, we have the stock assessment process. So how might be some of the changes here? Under EBFM, let's look at the, this is just a very quick snapshot. When we put the white paper together, we put these down as some of the key points, but obviously as we move into this, evolutions through transition, as I mentioned, these may change. In fact, it would be interesting to come back in 3 years' time and say, well, Bob, Mike, did you get this right? So seeing what did actually change and what not, or what are the changes? So the focus of planning, we feel, will be the ecological regions. And then the question has to be asked, do we need a PDT for each one of these? Do we need sub-PDTs, whatever? We need to have a transition plan. During the transition, is it the best to have the existing groups handle this? We feel it is. Let's have the existing groups manage the process. But obviously, we need to crosswalk the current planning PDT activities with the new ecological region PDTs. And the other thing that we found in other exercises, EBFM exercises elsewhere, it's really, really beneficial. Once we've established the priorities of ecosystem-based management, to take the existing management plans and crosswalk those to your priorities. Are there priorities that are being filled? Are there priorities that are being missed or whatever? It's like a gap analysis in your management system. That'd be all in the PDT levels. The SSC, greater consideration of socioeconomic consequences of EBFM. I mentioned the human dimension earlier, and then greater need for socioeconomic analysis And this is what we're talking about here. And then under the SAW process, the stock assessment process, need for peer-reviewed analysis of the overall state and productivity of each ecological region. Similarly, as we're having stock assessments now, we need to have integrated ecosystem assessments. So I'm going to end up with giving some next steps. Again, this is our view of what we need to do. And, of course, get your feed. We need to have your feedback on, well, okay, that's good, but you missed this and that sort of thing like this. So, firstly, define these new ecological regions. We have done some analysis, or Mike's team has done analyses on these, and we need to have a good full and discussion on what the consequences of using these regions would be. We need to identify priority issues and services associated with each region. We need to define the objectives, identify the risks of not achieving these. So as I mentioned earlier, we need to develop a suite of objectives that covers where we need to go, what we think are, and how these are going to address the risks of the ecosystem components that are really at risk. Develop the management strategies to achieve the EBFM. In this is this whole issue of allocations and trade-offs. How do we actually, so under the approach we are suggesting here, we are proposing, we have an overall level of productivity from an area. We allocate that amongst the resources. We're going to be confronting trade-offs. So how do we actually, what strategies do we do use to achieve those? And then, of course, we need to design the status and productivity reporting requirements and associated assessment tools required to monitor progress towards the objectives. Looking at some specific things that could be done in the short term, again, I think at the council level, really looking at the overall consultative process. That's something that we need to look at. where are we, if we're going to go into EBFM, does that need to change, and how will it have to change? As you mentioned earlier, these ecological regions, they have adjacent to them other areas like the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and the New England states. The efforts that we're being proposing here on EBFM will have some implications for those areas, and what they do in these areas will have implications for us here. So having some dialogue at the higher level with these other agencies, these other management agencies, will be very important for the council to undertake. In relation to planning and development teams, outline EBFM plan requirements. As we have fisheries management plan for single species now, let's look at the EBFM plan requirements. Dialogue with the current plan development teams to develop that transitional structure. So what's the best way to go here? And of course, they say they're designing the plan development team structures on EBFM. Lastly, we have to land with the SSA. Prepare a white paper on the socioeconomic analyses required by the EBFM. I think that's an important issue. So we're hoping, actually, it's interesting on this, that there was a number in the previous talk when Steve was mentioning about the risks and the socioeconomic impacts and the need to have the council to say, well, how should they engage? How can the council and the SSC interact? And when that dialogue was going on, I thought, this white paper actually could be quite useful to that process. It could be a template for, we have these issues. Here's the way we're going to think on doing. This will be the SSC to the council saying, here's what we're thinking about, and then there could be a response from the council on that. And then, of course, lastly, dialogue with the National Marine Fisheries Service and council staff on the needs of stock assessment, EBFM species, sociocultural, economic assessment needs. So basically, our assessment needs for ecosystem-based fisheries management. Now, last slide, of course, is the thank you slide. I do want to end with a couple of comments here, I guess. This is intentionally an overview. We did not get into a lot of details. As I mentioned, it's really to give you an overall view of where we're thinking of going from the SSC's perspective, and to get your feedback on, that's great, Bob, or where are you being, whatever. and get your feedback on where we need to go next. And maybe ask Mike, did you want to make any comments?
No, you did a great job. I'll just, if there are specific questions that I can answer about the types of analytical structures that the center is developing in support of this, I'd be happy to do that.
So that completes our talk on this. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Jimmy, then Doug?
Was there an analysis in this of how we would meet our legal requirements in an ecosystem management basis? Meaning, the way I'm looking at this is some stocks may go down. Actually, you termed it under one graph as collapse. So you, to me, that looked to me like you were assuming some stock may collapse as you manage this way, which we're not allowed to do under the legal requirements. So has that been looked at?
Jim, it's a pretty important part of what we're doing. So in showing that graph, we're not suggesting that it's in any sense desirable that you'd have some stocks driven to low levels, but rather the point of that particular graph was that if you just dial back on the exploitation rate, you greatly reduce the risk of having some stocks in that collapse state. You'll also recognize right away that you would also have other tools at your disposal to try to prevent that from happening, whether in some choosing from the list that Bob mentioned of the tools such as gear modification, and of course people have been quite active already in that and trying to minimize, for example, bycatch of winter flounder and so on. So those same kind of strategies would take place. But and in part of this allocation process, we emphasize that we'd set an overall cap on how much we think could be safely removed from the system, with the kind of common sense idea that I think everyone holds, that under a given set of environmental conditions, an area is going to produce so much fish and shellfish. But the other part of that allocation process is to put in some additional safeguards that say we can't let any of the stocks go below specified levels. And also there are social and economic considerations that would, might come in and create other kinds of constraints that you'd want to put in. So we would definitely do that. So your question is right on target. We definitely need to grapple with those issues, and we think that we have viable ways to address it.
Yeah, it looks to me like that may be one problem is, you know, something may collapse, and you're right, you can build something in there. But what about, seems to me that you're saying here that some may not rebuild under a prescribed timeline. So when you're under a rebuild problem, I don't know how this can fit into that under the requirements that we have. In other words, you're kind of saying that you're not going to get them all rebuilt in this prescribed timeline.
Well, I mean, what it's really saying is that that set of issues that you have to grapple with single species management still would hold under this ecosystem approach. But if you if it were accepted that you could accommodate trade-offs, you might, if it were, and this would require, I think, not a change in the Magnuson Act, but a change in the guidelines, you might, if it were accepted, to have some greater flexibility. But you'd never want to have a circumstance where you'd drive the stocks below some critical threshold level. And in this case, under our current guidelines, you know, you would never let them go anywhere near below quarter BMSY.
Can I add to that? That in fact, I think that's a significant issue in relation to the proposal we're making here. Is that in the existing management system, we don't know if this is all mutually compatible. And underneath the new process, we're thinking let's at least bring that on the table and have a look at. So, you know, I think. And your first comment in relation to the legal and legislative that we did talk about that in the SSC, and that came up as an issue in some of the other, in the Wakefield last week. And I take your point. I think what, Mike has, appropriately responded. I think that it would be useful for the SSC, though, as follow-up, to go back and say, okay, what are exactly, specifically, legally, are some of the issues? Thank you very much. So that's a good comment, Jim.
Doug?
my question has to do with species that have high migration rates. They go between multiple ecosystems. And in the examples I come up with are river herring, bluefin tuna, and I know that's not within the purview of the council, but clearly if we're looking at it from the council's going to an ecosystem-based management system, I would think that in the bigger picture, our HMS division might be looking at this. Also, even within some of the species that we have responsibility for management or co-management, such as herring and spiny dogfish, mackerel, that do you allocate yield between different portions of each ecosystem in these kind of, or is that something we have to work out? Or my final question would be, has anybody who has dealt with ecosystem management, so I saw some examples in your paper, dealt with species that migrate between different ecological units, and quite a number of them.
Really good questions, and we're obviously going to have to work through this as we get into this. This whole issue of space, spatial extent of these various resources is central. I think place ecosystem management is place-based management. There are different scales of space, though. And we're saying that, okay, we have these ecoregions. Now, energy in these ecoregions, and we're saying that we should view the basis of ecosystem-based fish management. But within each one of these, there is going to be some levels of some species that are, in fact, a very small scale. And there are going to be, as you mentioned, there are going to be some species that actually transcend all those regions. And I can't say how this is going to be done specifically, but it's going to be something we're going to have to work through. And maybe Mike's got a better answer, but...
Well, just to add to that, it obviously is a critical issue, Doug, and as you noted from the slide that Bob showed, you know, when we put up those possible management areas, they're identified one as being open and interconnected, and the connections are through water mass movements and also migratory behavior or movements of some species. We have a reasonable handle on the migratory pathways of many of these species and the times at which they're in different parts of this broad area that we talked about. That's true of both the small pelagics and the large pelagic species. So the idea would be to make an allocation for those species that are traversing multiple spatial units, that you would make a calculation of how much production they're both consuming and contributing to the different areas and the times in which they spend them. So it does add a complication. There's no question about that, but we can definitely do that. And, you know, to a certain degree, we're already having to do some of those kinds of things, certainly for transboundary resources that are, you know, shared between U.S. and Canada and so forth. So it's doable. It's more difficult. And it may, to some degree, increase additional levels of uncertainty in some parts of it. But I think we can do a reasonable job at it.
Wouldn't your objectives that you set at the outset help to inform that as well? The objectives the council would set for each sub-region would help define some of the answers to Doug's questions?
Yeah, and if we could address the issue and start to grapple with the issue of objectives very early on, John, it would be really important because, you know, that sets, you know, Bob talked about this roadmap, but in order to have a roadmap, we really need to know where we're going, and that's where the desires of the council come in terms of specifying an objective. But one of the things that really struck me in reading the postmortem of the early years of the New England Fishery Management Council by Jake Dykstra and Spencer Apollonia was a concern that they raised that they felt in the initial years of single species management under the council system, they weren't given sufficient guidance in terms of what objectives might look like. So to the extent that that's true, we don't want to repeat that mistake and try to work in quite early on and being very specific about what helpful objectives would be for the council.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. I thought the presentation was very good, and I have a question and then a follow-up question, and hopefully I'll characterize this correctly, so if I don't, please correct me. But there was some discussion about different methodologies for developing an overall cap for an ecosystem region, and I think the two methods that were discussed were, you know, identifying surplus production by an ecological region, or a multi-species assessment model. And it seems like between the two of them, a multi-species assessment model sounds extremely complex, and how you would take, you know, what you put up on your slide of the interactions of all of those species and the thought process of doing that just makes, you know, that gives you a headache. Whereas the surplus production one seems simpler and maybe more doable. Is that a correct interpretation, do you think?
They're tackling the problem from different directions, Mary Beth. And the first one that Bob showed, where we showed that kind of trophic pyramid where we're tracing energy through, is pretty simple. It has an advantage. It's not making any equilibrium assumptions. It's recognizing that things are going to change as the amount of food coming in at the base of the food web comes in, and we can track that with satellites now. And it's also, even though it's a really simple model, it's actually been proven to work pretty well. I mean, the first attempts to do those kinds of calculations go back almost 40 years now, and one of the most prominent ones was to get an estimate of the global catch that you could expect from the world fisheries. And it was published in 1969, and they projected that you could take about 100 million tons annually as surplus production from the system. And that turns out to be a pretty close estimate of what we're actually getting now. So even though it was simple, it seemed on this global level to do pretty well. So that's one of the reasons it's attractive to us to do that. But the broader part of the story is we actually want to try a bunch of different ways. And if they all give us the same basic answer, then we can feel better about the advice that we give to you. And it is true, as you said, that particular multi-species model that we showed is more complex. It has 21 species. It has size structured information, and it has explicit interactions among species in it. But one thing we've also been doing is to say, what if you dial that one back a notch? You had the same basic structure, but instead of accounting all the way through in the model for the 21 species in that case, you took the aggregate production, the total amount of yield, and the total amount of biomass of that group, and did a calculation on that. How would you do? And we've been testing that with simulation to say, all right, suppose we can play God and we know that, you know, how many species there are and how they're interacting. And then we try this trick of just aggregating them all and doing a production model on the total. Where can we go wrong if we're doing that? And, you know, the basic answer is that if you, and it will come as any surprise, if you aggregate species that have very different biological characteristics, particularly ones that are much lower productivity, and in that vein you would think of the elasmobranchs and you would think about redfish, for example, compared to some others. If you lump them all together, unless you play this trick of dialing back the exploitation rate to a safe level, you can get in trouble that way, and it would create the problem that Jim was alluding to earlier about having some dropping out. You know, again, you have other options at you. So one thing we have been looking at is if you are going to do these aggregate groups, let's sure we group them in ways where they're fairly similar in terms of basic biological characteristics. And, you know, when we do that, we have pretty good success of not having a problem by aggregating them. So it's an intermediate step of simplification, and we're trying all these, you know, there's actually about 8 models that we're using at the center to try to test. And one of them at the far end of the spectrum is really complex, and the others run the gamut along the lines we've just been talking about. So I think the main point is to try a bunch of stuff, and if we can convince ourselves that you can't go badly wrong with the simpler ones, we feel that the simpler ones are better because, you know, they're more intuitive, they're easier to explain, and so far the evidence is that they're more robust and stable than some of the other types of models that you might have where you're trying to track every little bit in the ecosystem.
Just a quick follow-up, which I think you've kind of already got there in that you're testing out different models and seeing what kind of output you get from that. And so I was curious if when you're doing that testing, are you, like, if you know what your production is and you could decide, you know, how much your removal rate would be and your max there. I mean, if you look back at historical data to see how that might match up with what we have taken out versus what you would calculate the production, surplus production for that time period to be, have you run tests like that?
We would actually fit them in the practice. We would fit the models to the actual historical data and to try to do exactly what you're talking about. But, you know, the part I was talking about with the simulation was just to try to convince ourselves in, you know, in a virtual world whether it works, because if we found in that case it didn't work, then we wouldn't go any further with it. So yeah, the answer is that we would actually use the real data, as you're suggesting, to test it and to see what happens. And, you know, Bob mentioned earlier that during the years of the International Commission for Northwest Atlantic Fisheries, some of these kinds of general approaches were applied, and one of them was some of these simple production models that helped them set an overall estimate of how much you could take out of the shelf system. So I guess that's by way of saying, you know, we're not doing anything that's so scary that it hasn't been tried and actually applied in that case before.
Dave Gittle.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I wholeheartedly endorse your work, and I hope it continues with all due speed. The sooner we can write a requiem for single-species management, the happier I will be. I wrote a lot of notes here, but most of them are on the nuts and bolts of doing this, and I think they'd be better suited to discussion offline or with you as individuals in the essence of time. I did have 2 things that I think you will need to do kind of before you proceed, or at least this will be my suggestion to help make this happen. I agree with Jimmy Odlin that, you know, in this slide on page 12 at the bottom here, that need to configure ecosystem RPs consistent with national guidelines. I'd say you actually have to do just the opposite. I think you need to get the national standard guidelines in sync with ecosystem-based management. I do think it's going to constrain you. I think it will be used to confound you and to hold this process up. And with that in mind, I would suggest that as a group, you go through the national standard guidelines, identify any areas of potential conflict, and write a letter to headquarters as soon as possible to get on with seeing if we can streamline that system. And the second one is on trade-offs. And that is also, I think, a place where you could be short-circuited, if you will, that by not by the council identifying acceptable trade-offs, first of all, we'll have a huge battle amongst ourselves. And then everybody that's a save the whatever, and everything has a constituency today, will be in here saying, no, mine's more important than yours. I think the way to handle that is to get out in front of that from a scientific perspective and identify acceptable trade-offs from a scientific perspective, and then also to identify what the bounds of those trade-offs are. Are they plus or minus 5%, 10%? Put some kind of limiting factors on it right up front so that people don't think, well, we're going to exterminate this so we can get more of that, because that's not true. That's not ecosystem-based management. We're going to have some of everything. And I think it would also help to identify, in where these conflicts are going to occur. And it's going to take, quite frankly, I think, some scientific courage, because if you, and I'll use this as a wild example, I don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow that the New England Council endorsed it. But let's say, for an example, there was a certain marine mammal in which we decided that the population had exceeded acceptable biological limits and was hindering the greater ecosystem, and you were to propose some kind of process that would shrink that population, whatever it might be, that we would need to have that out there and have it fully vetted and discussed before it was announced to the public in general, which would immediately take sides and say, oh, no, save this, or oh, no, kill that. But that requires a change in thinking from what we have now, where certain things are literally off the table that we can't even consider dealing with them because their constituencies are so politically powerful. So that's just two ideas I had in mind. Maybe you'd like to comment on them or not, but I think those are necessary first steps before we as a council try to set the objectives, because we need to know what the limits are up front.
Thanks for that, David. I think that's you've nailed. Coming into this talk, I saw the trade-offs as being actually, it's interesting. I saw the trade-offs as being an issue for sure, like in relation to further exploration for the council of how we actually were going to deal with this under EBFM. And I saw actually the legislation bit as well, so you've hit the two big ones for me anyway. And I think that in relation to these trade-offs, I think that defining the objectives at the very beginning of the game, so where collectively is the council going and what are the sensitive ecosystem components and where do we want and what are the risks to them? I think at the very beginning of that process, that will help define what the trade-offs are. That gives us the basis of moving forward on these trade-offs. Anyway, yeah, thank you.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Bob. Mike, excellent report, and my comment may lead us into the next guest speaker about coastal marine spatial planning. I noticed you had a slide on the Ocean Policy Task Force, and the council sent a letter to NROC, who's going to be that regional planning group, and we asked to have a seat on that regional planning group, and they said yes. So at the first meeting that I attended, they talked about their priorities for regional planning. And one is renewable energy, the second is ecosystem health, and the third is human resources, specifically fishing. And they talked about the trade-offs with renewable energy, trade-offs with fishing and renewable energy. And I was impressed by, basically I said all the fishing grounds are important. I wasn't going to give in to anything there. But they said, well, you got to prioritize them. Some have to be less important than other fishing grounds, and I said I wouldn't do that. I'd rather see the renewable energy take into consideration things before we give in fishing. But I notice your spatial management units talk about productivity and biodiversity. And so is this something scientific, these production units, where we would want to protect those and enhance those so that we could minimize any trade-offs with renewable energy sites, because this is a high productive area, and we've never talked about that. We've talked about essential fish habitat, but we've never talked about energy and production. And I think I want to leverage that as we talk about trade-offs with renewable energy.
Well, since you mentioned that, Paul, because I think that, yes, these ecosystem ecological units, certainly for the marine environment, can become the basis, I think, anyway, of these EBM units offshore. And I think by adopting this approach, the council's going to get ahead of the curve here. And when we talked about cumulative impacts, we mentioned the SASE model for cumulative impacts. I mean, that can be extended to any human activity. And then all of a sudden, you're looking at comparing fishing impacts to renewable resource, to anything else, oil and gas, marine mining, wherever you want. Thank you very much. The structure that we deliberately chose a structure when we rolled this out that is, dare I, if somebody else was in ecosystem-based management and read this white paper, they'd immediately see themselves. This is nothing unusual. This is ecosystem-based management applied to fisheries. So you can slot right into the NROC, the EBM process, whatever. And, those the dialogue on the trade-offs between, say, sectors is very apropos, and you're going to get ahead of the curve by doing this.
Just a bit more information on that, Paul. So the figure that you're seeing with the ecological regions, those are ones that hang together in terms of characteristics of productivity that we'd like to think about as having the main, or at least potentially the main areas to think about for developing these integrated management plans. What we didn't have space to do, and what we will do next time and time to do next time, is to tell you about some additional analyses that we've done that take that as a starting point and recognize that, there's a lot of spatial richness in those larger areas. It happens that, for the most part, those are still smaller than what we're currently using for most stock areas. So they're more discrete. But nonetheless, you'll all recognize that there's a much richer spatial detail. And so two things that would be of interest, I think, to what you're saying is that we've also done analyses based on our trawl survey data and also on our benthic data to find out basically where are the hot spots within those areas. And the hot spots are defined in two ways, one by the total biomass that we have in those areas, and the second one is the total number of species. So you can go through that and find out the ones where you would really want to key in on if you had to make a choice for additional protection, and it would come into play with the issue of an energy siting question. The other thing that we've done is, and Bob quite properly really highlighted the importance of the human part of the story, and we've mapped by port, gear type, and vessel size over the last 5 years where the vessels have been operating in relation to the boundaries that we're putting in. Just so, now obviously where someone fishes now is obviously dependent in part on the current regulations. There's no question about that. But we are also trying to find out if there are things that we see based on these ecological characteristics that the fishermen also see and they go to as a result. And we're finding that the basic answer to that is yes, that they're, fishermen are keying in on some high productivity areas, for example. And there's some really interesting and probably not surprising differences by vessel size, class, and gear type about how they operate. And that has a lot to do with the social dimensions. The smaller boats, the day boats, see that environment in a very different way than someone who's operating a trip boat. So we've done that kind of mapping to try for us to understand how people might react to some of these suggestions. We've also mapped, we had over the last 5 years for the 19 sectors where the vessels that are now in a sector had operated in the past to try to also see, well, where, now obviously things, it's a different world and they're going to change where they're fishing perhaps in different ways. but we've also mapped where the vessels from different sectors operated, so to get the same sense, because, you know, we know that you've already just gone through a very tumultuous overhaul of things, and we want to find out not only, we're not coming here to say, you know, we want to wipe the, you know, get rid of the baby with the bathwater, but try to understand how we can operate in a way that takes advantage of what we've learned already in both the kinds of protections that have been put in place and the way the sectors and fisheries are operating now. But I guess the main message is that, and to start with Bob's point, you know, ecosystem-based management is coming. You know, with this signed, with the president having signed this executive order, it's a really big deal. And, you know, we can either be on the EBM bus or we can be under it. And since we, none of us, I'm sure, want to be EBM roadkill, I think it'd be to our advantage to move fast on this.
A lot of roadmaps and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today, doctors. My way of looking at this, I mean, I think it represents an exciting opportunity to continue to explore. That's why we've talked about you coming back again in January and April. Continuing the discussion about how management could consider changing to a place-based concept or principle and managing human activities in a defined area as opposed to how we do things now. So there's a lot of complications, a lot of questions, legal and otherwise, that need to be worked out, and that's why I think it's important that, you know, the SSC has prioritized this for a couple more meetings. You've put together this white paper, and we should explore it over the course of 2, 3, 4 council meetings and really give it a fair airing, both here at the table, and encourage council members to talk with SSC members offline as well and begin to explore the possibilities. There's definitely going to be some trade-offs, as you've said, and people need to get right in their mind what those trade-offs are. So taking it slow and easy and building up over time is the way I think we should approach things. So I appreciate the efforts you've put in thus far and look forward to seeing the council and the SSC begin to interact a little more on this topic. Any more questions? Sally?
Yeah, so my concern is about next steps, kind of recognizing the general quiet energy in the room and not wanting to lose some potential, any momentum that there might be. So I have two questions. One, I'm wondering if there's some information coming from the Mid-Atlantic on what they are doing with respect to an ecosystem-based approach that can help New England figure out what to do next. And then the other thing is, I'm wondering if there's a need to give some kind of a little bit further direction to the SSC or guidance to the SSC from the council at this point, so that it's clear that there is support from the council, because I don't know that that necessarily is, despite the comments that you've just made and understanding that we're going to get some more, there's going to be some more just general discussion in January and April. So Mid-Atlantic, and what do we need to do to make sure that this keeps moving forward?
I know the Mid has an ecosystem subcommittee of their SSC, and I'll ask the chairman to briefly describe the principles and goals of that committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, the Mid did recently establish a ecosystem subcommittee within the SSC. Jason Link is going to chair that subcommittee. There's a lot of interest in that on the SSC, so it will probably be a very substantial committee in terms of its membership, and we've just given them terms of reference, and so those terms of reference would include identifying how the council could incorporate ecosystem structure and function into its decision-making processes as we set quotas and specifications. So it kind of lays out a principle-based approach for incremental progress, but then it also ask some longer-term questions in the TORs about how we might transition towards ecosystem-based management. And I think that's more of what's been laid out here from what I've seen today is sort of the longer-term view of how the ecosystem-based plans could work. But, you know, the concern I have in the interim is as we move forward, I think we can incorporate the principles within our existing FMPs and decision-making, but as we look at coastal marine spatial planning and the push through the National Ocean Policy, that's going to be a forcing issue driving us toward ecosystem management in the broadest sense. And I think it's going to be some time before we have all the scientific products that we need to support to fully support ecosystem-based fisheries management. So as we go through this, I mean, obviously we're going to have interim strategies. I mean, that's sort of what we're focusing on in our subcommittee right now is how to make incremental progress. But at the bigger picture, I think we are going to be pushed through this CMSP process to consider the broadest types of ecosystem management. So I think as we go forward, we have some real transitional challenges.
Mike? To say that the reason that in the brochure that you have, you'll notice that it comes under a NOAA logo and it's not specific to the New England Fishery Management Council. And as much as you are near and dear to our hearts, we also know that we need to serve the needs of the Mid-Atlantic Council and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And the reason that it's presented in this way and in more general is to try to help in each of our major players in terms of the management. And so we have been fortunate enough to be able to interact with the committees at the Mid-Atlantic Council and also with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. So, and as Bob pointed out, we really need to, you know, approach this together as a team, because it's more than we certainly don't want to treat them as balkanized with, you know, New England doing this and Mid-Atlantic doing that.
Are you saying that we would assume the responsibilities and role of the Mid and we get rid of the Mid, or
only the blame?
Only the blame.
These guys would get the credit.
Well, I know in our SAS ARCs now, the TORs contain ecosystem considerations, and I think that's when you look at the white paper, which I'm not sure, have we released the white paper to the council yet? Or is it still in draft form at the SSC?
It's a year.
Okay.
So you have the draft. It's still marked as draft, but if you're happy with it, then it will be an approved product.
Yeah. I'd like to get it into the hands of the council members so that we can get better dialogue going between the council and the SSC. But if you look at the even some of the slides, you talk about a transitional period before we go to a full EBFM. That's the proposal. And I note that in the SAS ARC, we already have TORs that are ecosystem-based. So perhaps the next time you come back to us, we could focus on that transitional phase as well. And you could bring some specific examples of how what we're doing now and what you're proposing in that transitional period, what changes would be necessary to make that happen. Also, we'll get the draft white paper to the council members, so they'll have had an ample amount of time to have read it between now and January, the end of January, and they'll come prepared with other specific questions as well. Sally?
Could we also have the terms of reference from the MID so that we can see what's going on there, not necessarily to copy it, but just to kind of understand what's going on to the south?
I think that's a good idea. Chairman Robbins, you'll make sure we get a handle on those? Okay. Anything further? Dr. Bob.
One thing you might look at is when you're looking at, because we think next time we get together, say in January, I had two issues, legislation and I think the trade-offs type thing, there might be others, but maybe it would be worthwhile for the council to sort of say, okay, give us, so just let us know in January, have some discussion and say in January, this is what specifically we'd like to hear. John, you mentioned the transitional, focus on the transitional. That's good too. One way to maybe structure that discussion is to say, okay, there are what I call the functions of ecosystem-based management, which is the roadmap, defining objectives, identifying spatial units, that sort of thing, trade-offs and so on, and then the structures of ecosystem-based fishermen. These are the institutions. And I think maybe if you sort of said what functions do we need to hear about and what structures do we need to hear about, that might be a way of structuring the discussion in January and April.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time and your efforts. We look forward to seeing you again. I'm going to take a quick bathroom break, and then we'll have the last agenda item, which is